Every year when you get your garden catalogs, you find something new in there. Where do all of those new plants come from? And how do you know if they'll grow well in Iowa? Today, we'll answer those questions. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. I'll talk with Aaron Stile. He is manager of public programs at Ryman Gardens in Ames. This hour, we're going to talk about the trial gardens at Ryman, where new and recently introduced plants are growing. Ryman uses this space to find out what new plants will grow well in your garden. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here. He and Aaron will answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will join us in a few minutes to answer your questions. But first, we're going to talk about new plants that you might want in your garden next year or sometime in the future. Aaron Stile is manager of public programs at Ryman Gardens in Ames. And today we're going to talk about the trial gardens at Ryman. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, how much space at Ryman Gardens is dedicated to the trial gardens?
We have a fair amount of space, actually, probably equivalent of about a half acre of trial gardens right now. And we're actually working to expand the area as the years go on because we've found out that people really enjoy looking at all these plants and we enjoy growing all these new things.
Where do the new plants come from?
Well, we work with a lot of different folks, and mostly right now we are working with a few seed companies that produce and distribute a lot of the annual plants that you see in your local greenhouses every spring. Primarily right now we're working with Ball Horticultural, which is outside of Chicago, and then we also work with Benary Seed, which originated in Europe, actually, but have several outlets here in the U.S. And those two companies, along with many others, are constantly breeding and developing mostly new annuals, sometimes vegetables, these kind of plants that you put out for the summer and enjoy with lots of great color, the petunias, the impatiens, the zinnias, and all of that. And so we get some of their new things and tell them how they do for us so that they can decide whether they're worth pursuing or whether they're worth releasing to the public or whether they're just terrible plants and they should just abandon it.
Do you get any kind of say in what kinds of things you'll be testing?
No, and that's kind of the fun of it, because every spring our test garden manager, Jesse Liebenguth, gets this list from these companies, and it's always kind of fun to see what they're going to send us.
You also have a fairly new relationship with All America Selection. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, All America Selection is a great program. It's been around for many years, and they are dedicated to trialing plants, and they award a winner status to exceptional annuals and vegetables in the garden across the country. And there are about 50 gardens in the U.S. and Canada that serve as trial locations. They're spread across all different climate areas and all different soil types and just all different corners of the country. And those plants that trial well in all of those locations are awarded the kind of a seal from the AAS. And Ryman Gardens recently became one of those trial locations.
Now, we have put up a picture on our Facebook page of your trial gardens. We'll put up a gallery of some of the pictures that you sent me of the trial gardens. But give us an idea of how you set this up. So you get the seeds, you have a plot of land. How do you decide where and how to plant these plants?
So a lot of the plants that we get in as seed. And so it starts with growing them out in our greenhouses to a transplantable size. So a lot of this planting starts back in January and February. And so we grow them out in the greenhouse. Usually, as soon as the frost-free date has passed, sometime in early May, we'll get them out into the garden. We have a series of raised beds, and it's very systematic the way that the garden is laid out, because we're looking at trying to easily compare these plants to standards that we put in the garden. There are some plants in the trial garden that our old standbys, ones that we know perform well and are great barometers to use to compare these new ones to. And so we'll plant all these things together, usually in little squares with tidy little rows and in little blocks, and kind of go from there. And what happens in the trial garden then is we get these beds with these blocks of color, because we have these kind of squares of, you know, the whole bed will be petunias, but there'll be 16 different petunias in that bed, and they'll all vary in color, and they form these tidy little blocks. And you can see real easily, just glancing at the bed, which ones seem to be doing really great and which ones aren't.
Well, and it's rare at Ryman Gardens, which of course is a beautiful, beautiful place, to see a bed where some of the plants don't look so good. Is that painful sometimes?
It is
for
very
you?
Painful sometimes to watch these plants. You know, every once in a while, some of these plants just don't do well in Iowa. You know, they may have been bred with a different part of the country in mind, or they may have just not been thoroughly tested yet by the company or the organization that's sponsoring the trial. And so they get in our garden and they just languish. And occasionally we've had some situations where they get so bad that we do abandon it. But usually they just sit there and they just look their pitiful self, and we use it as a teaching opportunity. And so when you go through the trial garden, by and large, the whole thing looks beautiful. But every once in a while, you have one of those little spots where they don't look so great. And I think one of the pictures I sent you highlighted that. That was kind of hard for me to decide if I should send that to you or not.
that is true. That's not the one we put on our Facebook page, but you can see it on the website later on today.
Yeah.
So when you grow these plants and you see how they do, mm-hmm. are there other people growing them in other parts of the Midwest or even in other parts of Iowa?
Yeah. And with the companies that we have relationships with, like Ball and Benary seed companies, they are growing them in their own trial gardens. And sometimes those trial gardens are located, like in the case of Ball, it's located outside of Chicago. So it is a very similar climate to ours. But other companies are in different parts of the country, in California. Sometimes we get stuff from Florida. So these areas obviously have very different conditions. And so they're really interested to see how they would do in the Midwest or in central Iowa and how that would play out into where they can sell this plant. Does it have a wide market appeal? Because if it does, then it is something they will want to invest in promoting and producing for greenhouses across the country.
And how do you evaluate them? Do you have a sheet that you send back to the company? Does someone come from the company to see?
Yeah, so our trial gardens manager, Jessie, she goes out on a regular basis, sometimes as much as once a week, and she'll evaluate them very formally, clipboard and paper. She'll have some criteria that she's looking for. Some of the organizations like AAS have official judges training, and they'll give you official sheets to use to evaluate the plants based on certain criteria like form and vigor and color. And they'll even ask us sometimes, do you think people would buy this plant? And so not only can we just evaluate them on their appearance, but what's also great about the situation that we have is that the person who takes care of the garden is also the evaluator. And so she can also speak very, very well to how the plant grows. And, you know, did we have to apply a lot of fertilizer, or does it seem really vigorous? Did it germinate well in the greenhouse, and was it easy to produce? Because those are all things that are important for greenhouse growers.
How long does it take from seeing a plant that has come to your trial garden that does well? How long does it take to see that in the catalogs?
You know, a lot of times we're one of the last steps. These companies, especially the ones that we're working with, they have done extensive trials on their own. And so a lot of times we're 1 or 2 years away from them thinking about releasing it. And that's nice because we don't get as many dogs that way. But it usually isn't too long before we see some of them. And we also have served for many years as a rose trial garden. And many times those roses, we don't even know the names for the plants because they don't want you to be somehow biased by it. And so we only know the plant by a number and by a color. And so often we're not even entirely sure if the one we trialed is this new plant that came out, because we never actually knew what it was called.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Are there any standouts this year?
Well, there are a few that we really like. There's this program that's run by the All-America Selection. It's called the American Garden Award. And there are some pretty exceptional annual plants. They have four that are up for public vote this year, and all four of them look fantastic in the garden. There's an impatience called Sun Patience. It's an orange flower. There's a double petunia that's pink. There's a verbena that's called Candy Cane, Lanai Candy Cane. That's really cool. And then a dark red Zahara Zinnia. And those four plants, all four of them look great, but we've been folks have been available to vote for their favorite one all
summer
long.
So if I visit Ryman, then I can vote on these plants.
You can, and you can see them in real life. You can see how they're doing here, and you can go online. You can send in a postcard. You can drop off a ballot physically at the garden. We have a little mailbox out there that you can drop it in, and they keep tallies on it across the country. So there are multiple sites that are doing this across the country. And you can actually go to that website and see who's winning right now.
And who's winning right now?
Well, between those four, there's a verbena that has 41% of the national vote. And it is a really nice plant. It's kind of a white flower with a dark pink stripe in it. And it's very striking.
You also had another opportunity for people to vote this summer. You held your first ever flower caucus.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
What was that?
Well, you know, every year Ryman Gardens has a theme, and that theme kind of dictates a lot of the programming and displays that we do all year. And this year the theme is called More Than Meets the Iowa, and everything is related back to the great state of Iowa. And so we thought, you know, Iowa is known as the first in the nation caucus state, and we have this wonderful trial garden that is a lot about voting and picking your favorite, and so why not put the two together? So we held a flower caucus, and it was an event that we did a couple weeks ago. We had folks vote for their favorite or caucus for their favorite plant in the trial garden. We used flags, and so people could take a flag and stick it in the ground at their favorite plant, and at the end of the day, was very clear which one had the most flags. We also had information about caucus from both Democrats and Republicans in Story County. They brought memorabilia in. We had a panel discussion. It was a really great, really fun day.
Was it as much of a circus atmosphere as the straw poll in Ames?
You know, or? There was it rained a little bit. That it was like the only day in July that threatened rain, and so I think it scared off a few people. We had a nice crowd regardless, but it wasn't quite as circus like as the caucus can be.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break. We will be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Aaron Stile, who is the manager of public programs at Ryman Gardens in Ames. He'll stay with us, and also Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here in just a moment. And you are welcome to ask your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Aaron Stile, the manager of public programs at Ryman Gardens in Ames. And Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is also here. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. And you have had a tomato failure in your own garden this year?
Well, not my own garden per se, the home demonstration garden.
Oh, no.
We didn't get it planted till early June because of the wet weather, and so they're just behind. So they're growing, they're doing nice, but no ripe tomatoes yet.
Nothing to eat yet.
Nope.
That's heartbreaking this time of year.
It is.
You can join us with your questions about tomatoes or petunias or anything you want to talk about. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we've got an emerald ash borer question to start off. This is from Michael, and he says, does the current threat to ash trees, the emerald ash borer, attack all species of ash?
Yes, it does, unfortunately. So any native or introduced ash, for the most part, should be, well, is vulnerable. So green ash, white ash, blue ash, etc. So it's basically going to devastate the ash population.
All right. And here's an email from Laura. She says, my evergreen tree has been diagnosed and treated for bagworms. Almost half of the tree has turned brown from the top down. Will it come back or do I need to have it removed?
Boy, that's hard to say. I would be inclined to wait till spring and see what it does. Does it push out some new growth? If it does, it can recover. If it doesn't, then it's not going to. So I would wait till spring, let it start to grow and leaf out, and then reevaluate it.
All right. And of course, you can join our conversation with your questions. We've got lines open for you right now at 866-780-9100. You can also send email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Richard's on the line next in Solon. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes. I had some grass that was growing great for 5 or 6 years. Then 2 years ago after that drought, patches of it died out. And I tried to replace it last fall and then again this spring, and I can't seem to get anything to grow. Any suggestions?
Okay. Is it sun or shade?
Sun.
Okay. And right now, what do you have? Is it mainly weeds? What do you have? Bare ground?
Bare ground.
Bare ground. Well, I would sow some grass seed, and I would be shooting for the first week in September. And if you have bare ground, go out there and at least rake it to break the soil surface.
Yeah, yeah.
Then sow your grass seed.
Actually, I did that last fall and then again this spring. And I dug down about 3 or 4 inches and dug it out. I mean, broke it up real good. Mm-hmm. And then I put a light covering of straw on it and tried to keep it damp. And it just didn't seem to grow.
Well, it should if you do everything correctly. So like I said, rake the area to break the soil surface. Buy some good quality grass seed. Go to a garden center, buy some good quality grass seed. Sow the seed and then drag it or rake it into the soil just lightly.
Okay.
And then after that comes the point where you have to water, and it may be once or twice a day.
Okay.
For maybe 2 or 3 weeks. You're just trying to keep the upper inch of soil moist.
Okay.
So you don't have to water a lot. You just have to do it often.
Do it often.
And you can use some straw. When you're done seeding, you can spread some straw on the area.
Okay.
And that does slow evaporation of water from the soil. So you don't have to water as often. But the key is you have to water typically once or twice a day to keep that soil bed moist. And if you do, it should come up hopefully in 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay. Well, I guess I must not have. I watered it heavy and then tried to water it again, but maybe I just didn't.
Yeah, you just have to do it often.
How thick can that straw layer be?
Well, when you're done applying the straw, and you look down, you see mainly straw, but you see little patches of soil too. So it's not very thick.
Not very thick.
No.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Good luck, Richard. I hope it works this time.
I hope so, too.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Justin is up next from Durant. Hello, Justin.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
This year, I'm having some infestation of the black Japanese beetles on my roses and basil in my garden. Is there anything from a kind of an eco-friendly way without spraying, like insecticides, et cetera, that I can better combat them?
Well, it's difficult. They're typically around for 4 to 6 weeks in mid to late summer. And so you can destroy what's there, and then you get more coming in from adjacent areas. So it's kind of a problem. One option is simply to go out in the morning early. And at that point, they're very sluggish, and you can simply pick them off the plants and then drop them in soapy water. Okay, you can do that. Works very, very nicely. Some of the neem products might provide some control. That's a organic-type insecticide. Otherwise, it's basically your more traditional insecticides, like 7 and 8, things like that.
I know at Ryman Gardens, we have a lot of Japanese beetle problems, especially on our roses and our grapes. And we go out and we try to take a more or a less chemical approach. And so that requires us to go out almost every other day, if not every day when it's really bad, with a bucket of water. And the nice thing is with the Japanese beetle, when you hit the plant or when you touch the plant, their natural thing that they do is they drop straight to the ground. And so if you position that bucket right over a big cluster of them and you tap the branch, they all just drop right into the bucket. And if you have a little bit of soapy water in there, they don't fly away. You kill them and you're done. I've also heard some people use a shop vac, which would be interesting to try maybe. I don't know how effective that really is because you're going to be pulling a lot of petals and leaves too. But if you're really desperate,
it's
you can always try
satisfying.
That. It is very satisfying. I don't doubt that at all. But yeah, it's going to be the challenge with not using chemicals is it's probably going to be a daily chore while they're out.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right, Justin, thanks a lot for your call. And I don't know if we've just gotten really lucky this year on our little patch of land, but we haven't had a lot of pests. We've had a minor Japanese beetle infestation. We don't spray our apple trees, and the apple trees are great this year. Has this been a trend, or did I win the lottery this year?
I would say in the Ames area, most areas have had far fewer Japanese beetles this year.
Yeah, we have too.
And so that's been noticeable. I've heard a lot of comments as I walk to work. I see far fewer this year compared to previous years, which is great.
That's really nice. Maybe we'll get lucky again next year, too.
Right.
That would be fun. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or our email address, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Phyllis is on the line from Ames. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
In June, my neighbor sprayed 2,4-D. And it drifted into my yard and right where my garden was and destroyed everything. Weeds that are coming up now in the otherwise bare soil are showing signs of 2,4-D damage. That is, the leaves are curling. Come spring, what do I need to do to detox the soil?
Well, actually, unless they reapplied that recently, I would not expect to see symptoms on the weeds at this point.
We haven't had any rain all summer.
Right, right. But still, basically when you have herbicide drift, the material gets on the foliage, and the foliage absorbs it, and it causes that distortion that you see typically with 2,4-D, where you see twisting and distortion, and eventually death if they get a large quantity. But there's nothing really in the soil per se, especially when you have drift. So I would have to assume that if you see symptoms later on that summer, that someone reapplied a broadleaf herbicide recently.
I don't think that was it. Hollyhocks in particular, when they grew back.
Well, but there wouldn't be anything typically in the soil per se, so I don't really think there's any need to detoxify the soil per se, because I really don't think there's any significant amount in the soil.
And it doesn't stay in the roots of the plants?
Not a great deal. Not a great deal as far as quantity, no. Typically with things like 2,4-D, you get most of your absorption through plant foliage, not the root system.
All right, Phyllis, I hope that shapes up for you. And when we had a similar thing happen with, I believe, Roundup drift from a neighboring field, and a number of our trees got hit on their leaves and lost some leaves. Is that going to be detrimental to the trees later on?
It really depends upon the exposure, how much they were exposed to. If you get some minor leaf drop, but the majority of the leaves remain on the tree, they're healthy, then I would assume that tree's probably in pretty good shape. So I would wait till spring. That should give you a pretty good idea. If it leaves out normally, it's fine.
Okay. Well, I figured we'd just take a wait-and-see approach to that one anyway. Anne is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Anne.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I'm wondering what's the time frame for fall pruning and flowering shrubs. How soon or how long, when's the best time to do it?
Well, I would not prune basically any shrub in the fall, actually. You can prune basically if you have a flowering shrub. Basically, if it's a spring flowering shrub, like a lilac, you can prune those in March, early April, before they leaf out, or immediately after blooming. If you want to do severe pruning, heavy pruning, I would do it in March, early April, and sacrifice the bloom for that year. If you just have some minor pruning, I would let the plant bloom first in the spring and then prune it immediately after blooming.
All right.
Prune it. When was it? What did you just say before that?
Well, if you have a spring flowering shrub like a lilac, and you need to do some...
I'm not thinking of lilac. You prune them in March or April or immediately after.
Right.
After blooming.
Right.
Is that right? And what about other flowering shrubs?
Well, the same thing. If they're spring flowering, like, let's say, forsythia, the same thing. The same thing, basically.
What kind of shrub are you looking to prune?
I'm trying to think. Some Nanking cherry, and there are some with white blooms, and I don't know what kind they are. And then there's a trying to think of some with that have red berries now.
Sure. Well, I would say that you would be hard pressed to find anybody recommending pruning in the fall. It's typically considered one of the worst times to prune a plant because you're opening up a plant with an injury that doesn't have any time to recover before the stresses of winter. So I would say with a very few exceptions, most of those shrubs that you were talking about are going to be best pruned in late winter, early spring.
All right, Anne, thank you so much for your call. Next up, Doris in Maynard. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we have some young apple trees, and they were doing just fine getting all new growth and stuff on them. And then all of a sudden, we started noticing these, it was getting spots on the leaves, so my husband had sprayed them. But it didn't make it go away. In fact, I've got a leaf in my hand here, and they're kind of misshapen, and then they've got kind of a brownish place in them, and then they're a little bit lighter brown, and then they're red on the outside of them. Can you tell me what's going on here and what we should be doing?
Okay. Well, I'm not sure exactly which one you have. You have a leaf spot, either apple scab or cedar apple rust.
Yeah.
Typically with apple scab, the spots are typically dark in color, typically a dark green, dark brown, or black. Okay. Then with cedar apple rust, the spots are typically yellow, and then you may see some red along the outer portion of that circle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
And by now, possibly, if you look on the underside of the leaf, you may see some structures that are basically sticking out, little hairs.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Those are the spore-producing structures of cedar apple rust.
Okay.
Okay. That disease goes back and forth between the cedar, or the red cedar, and the apple. Okay. And in the spring of the year, you see these rather gross-looking brownish-orange things in the cedar trees.
Okay.
Kind of gelatinous. Okay. And they're producing spores that are flying to the apple trees, infecting the foliage. And then it reproduces on the apple leaves where you see these little hair-like structures producing spores, and their spores are flying back to the cedar trees. So it goes back and forth. Okay.
We don't per se have cedar trees, but I suppose that can
you don't
go
have to.
Anywhere on the wind, doesn't
right.
it?
Right. They can fly miles in the wind. And cedars are very common in Iowa. They're ubiquitous across the landscape. You see them in roadside ditches, old pastures, wherever. So they're very common. So the main thing...
Do you think that's because of the weird spring we had this year?
Well, it plays a part in it, in that apple scab and cedar apple rust, both are fungi, and they both love wet weather in the spring. That favors their infection. So this year we had plenty of rain in May and June, ideal conditions for the infection, so we're seeing a lot of spotting of foliage.
Okay.
The bottom line, as far as the apple scab and cedar apple rust, they do cause some damage.
Mm-hmm.
The damage is fairly minor. It is not life-threatening. It is not. And at this point, there's no need to be spraying at this point because the infections occur typically in May and early June.
Okay, so would that be a time earlier in the spring is when we would be spraying?
Well, the problem with cedar,
or,
well, you possibly could, but the problem with cedar apple rust on apples is that I don't know of a fungicide that is registered for use on apples. I don't believe there is one currently on the market. But again, it's typically not a major problem, so I wouldn't worry about it too much.
The leaves just look awful on them, you know, and the new growth, it's still getting new growth, and, you know, and they'll be fine, and then pretty soon they'll start getting, you know, these spots on them, you know, and I don't know.
Well,
you say they'll be okay.
They should be fine. They should be fine. Now, when you're selecting an apple variety to plant, you might want to check into disease resistance, because the varieties do vary in their resistance to apple scab and cedar apple rust. Many have very good resistance. Some do not. And that's a factor, too. So,
all right, Dorice, thank you so much for your call. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back to answer many more of your questions about the plants in your life. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can post on our Facebook page. With me today is Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist, and Aaron Stile, Manager of Public Programs at Ryman Gardens in Ames. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist, and Aaron Stile, Manager of Public Programs at Ryman Gardens in Ames. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Next up is Ryan in Marshalltown. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I've got a question about pruning trees. I had a tree contractor out to my yard a week or so ago to remove a storm-damaged limb, and he mentioned, as I already knew, that the trees on my lot were pretty poorly maintained. They hadn't really been pruned properly. He mentioned a rule of thumb I hadn't heard before, and I wanted to run past you. He said that the first three quarters of a branch should be bare, so should be clear of additional branches.
So you're talking about the part of the branch that's closest to the trunk.
Right, yes. Is that a rule of thumb for all species? Is that just, I don't know, for the oak?
No.
Or is that just for the guy to make more money?
No, I would say no. When you look at a tree, most of the foliage is out toward the canopy, the outer part of it. I wouldn't use that as a rule of thumb, no. I would not.
No, I would be worried that you would be eliminating a lot of interior branches that aid to the structure of the plant. And instead, what happens is you get these big, long limbs, big, long, slender limbs with a ball of foliage at the end. They actually call
right.
it lion's tailing.
Right.
And it is something that you occasionally run into with arborists. And the problem with that is that big, long limb breaks very easily because it doesn't have any branches or leaves along it to provide local kind of food resources for the plant, and you have a big heavy ball of foliage at the end that creates a kind of a lever that makes it snap easier.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense.
I'm guessing, Richard, there's an extension publication that could probably help Ryan out a little more than that.
We do have a pruning publication, yes, that is available online.
I feel like I've looked through them all. I know the three step cut.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a better rule of thumb for thinning out what I can obviously by my untrained eye see are sort of overgrown trees?
Well, basically, if you have a fairly mature tree and it's been taken care of and pruned properly over the years, you probably shouldn't have to do much of anything. What I would look for basically would be what I would refer to as defects in the tree. Maybe branches, for example, where you have two and there's a very, very narrow crotch angle between the two. Maybe one of those should come out. Or if you have a branch that is growing upward or inward, maybe that should come out, type of thing. So basically things where you might have a defect or possibly where you have two branches that cross and rub against each other. Take out one of those. So basically looking at defects.
Okay. So no general kind of thinning? I'm just
shouldn't have
sort
to.
Of being like...
No. No, if you have like a shade tree, let's say you have a maple tree or a linden tree or an oak tree, I don't see any need to do any thinning in that tree. Basically, no, no. I would prune out defects, prune out dead or broken branches, and leave it at that.
All right, Ryan, thanks a lot for your call. Next up is Jackie in Story City. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I have a small lilac bush that has a bunch of the gray powdery mildew fungi on it, and everything that I've read says to prune it immediately and throw it away, but I don't want to do it in August, so I was wondering if there's anything else I can do, or do I have to worry about it coming back?
I wouldn't do a thing, because the powdery mildew, the damage is minor. It's mainly aesthetic. Where is the lilac growing? Is it full sun or part shade?
It's full. It gets sun all day long.
That's amazing, because normally you see that in partial shade.
That's what I was thinking, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I don't have it pruned right, or because I just let it go.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to worry about that as far as pruning it. I wouldn't do a thing at this point. I would rake the leaves when they fall and remove them from the area and see what happens again next year. But normally we tend to see powdery mildew when plants are growing in partial shade.
Yeah. Right. Is there a lot of other plants around it, or is it really close to a building or where there's...
It's close to our porch, but otherwise it's right next to our driveway and sidewalk.
Okay.
Right in full sun.
Occasionally you can also help if you can increase air circulation. So if it's really crowded, if you thin out things around it or thin the plant out a little bit, you can help with it. But like Richard said, it's not going to cause long-term health damage. It's really just an aesthetic thing.
Okay, that's what I was making sure of. I didn't want to kill the poor thing.
And trying to control it with a fungicide is difficult. So maybe a little bit of thinning, see what it does next year.
Okay, and then I just want to prune it in the spring. I don't want to do it right now, right?
No, I'd wait right, yes.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Jackie. Next, let's go to Tom in Iowa City. Hi, Tom.
Well, good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I was wondering how detrimental or deadly weed killer would be to pyramidal arborvitae trees, hostas, or I've also got an ivy ground cover. Would the weed killer hurt those if I got it too close?
Well, what kind of weed killer?
Let's see.
That's the magic
it's
question.
Vectorcide. I got it at an Ace.
Okay. That's more of a brand name, but.
Oh, boy. Gee whiz.
Basically, you probably have two types. You have things like glyphosate, which is non-selective, kills everything that you apply it to. And if you're using something like that, then you want to make sure that any plants that you want to save do not come in contact with the herbicide. Make sure they don't get any of it on them. You can spray right next to them and be just fine as long as you don't get it on them. And then you have certain things like your broadleaf herbicides like 2,4-D, dicamba, those type of things. They can drift, but again, if you're real careful, you should be okay. Applied only to what you want to kill, basically.
Okie doke. So spraying wouldn't be the best thing because that would drift quite a bit, right, or no?
Well, if you have a weed that you want to kill and it's growing very close to something else, what you can do maybe is use like a foam-type paintbrush and kind of dab it in the solution and then dab it on the foliage of the plant you want to kill. So you can do that in close quarters.
All right, Tom, good luck with that project. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. Ben is on the line next in Oskaloosa. Hi, Ben.
Morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I've got, I didn't have a very good year with my garden because of all the clay in it in the wet spring. And I want to know what to add to make it more fertile, so to speak, and allow me to work with it a little better.
I would get some organic matter, either compost, barnyard manure, something, and apply maybe 2 or 3 inches of it this fall. And then work it into the soil, till it into the soil thoroughly.
Okay, follow-up to that. I've got chickens, and I use wood chips with the chickens. Do you think that would be too strong to put on the garden or not?
Well, you have the wood, which is low in nitrogen, and the microbes break it down. They need nitrogen. But then again, you have the manure, which has nitrogen in it. So I'm not sure if they're going to be a problem there or not.
Would it be helpful to compost it a little bit first, Richard?
Yeah, that probably would be if you can.
Okay. All right, I'll try that. Thanks.
All right, Ben, thanks a lot for your call. And next, we've got Tom on the line in Cedar Falls at 866-780-9100. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Hey, got a great show. I'm going to have Richard earn his money now. I've got some trees in about a 10-acre area, and I've discovered poison ivy, and I've been using a 2,4-D product on it, and it seems to be controlling it. But what I'd like to know is how does poison ivy move over a large area? And then do animals, like, eat the seeds or and then I've also noticed that the poison ivy is turning color already, like it's later in the fall for other plants, and I just wonder what the growth period was in our area for that. And I'll take my answer off the air, and thanks a lot. You're doing a great job.
All right. Thanks for your question, Tom.
Well, poison ivy is a flowering plant. It does produce fruit. They're not very big. They're not very showy. They're small little berry-like fruit. They're kind of whitish in color. And yes, the birds find them very appealing. And so they eat the berries and distribute the seeds. As far as the fall color, normally they don't color until basically September, October. They can be actually very, very attractive in the fall when they turn color. They vary from orange to red. But when plants are under stress for some reason, they may color earlier.
And it makes me happy to hear poison ivy under stress.
I feel his pain, too. I think I probably have about as much poison ivy as he does. I just have, and it is. It's distributed by birds, and it's always under trees and in my garden beds, and it's a lot of work to get rid of.
Absolutely. All right, let's go to an email question now. This is from Kim in Iowa City. We planted 4 cherry trees last year, and they had done great. We got about 3 pounds of cherries this June. Now, one of the tree's leaves are starting to lose color, turning orangish. Should I water more? The other 3 are fine.
Well, it has been dry recently in most parts of Iowa, and if they were planted recently, I'd be watering those plants about every week to 10 days if it's dry, and really do a good job when you do so. And I would continue that through August, September, October, into early November if it stays dry.
All right. And we're going to get through a couple more email questions here, but we still have time for a phone call or two as well at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. This is an email from Dan. He says, my bell pepper plants in containers are showing curled leaves. Peppers are good and leaves are green, but curling in from the sides. I've read this can be too much watering, but I never thought it was possible to overwater container plants. Is that the case? I'm watering them once a day.
That sounds maybe a little bit too much. Mm-hmm. You can overwater. I would think if you overwatered, the leaves would kind of turn yellow and shrivel. But basically, if you overwater, you basically keep the soil saturated, and so the roots can't breathe. And if they can't breathe, some of them die. So basically, as far as watering those, I would water those until water begins to flow out the bottom of the container. And then I would allow that soil to dry out somewhat before you water again. So check it every day. But don't water automatically every day.
Yeah, and it really depends on the conditions, too. I mean, if it's hot, if it's sunny, if it's shady, if it's windy, all of those things will impact how often it needs to be watered. And so just watering it once a day can be really misleading, I guess.
All right. Another email. This is from Reno. I bought a Japanese maple bush. I remember the lady who sold them shaped them like bonsai trees. I have no clue on how to shape these. The tree's about 2 feet high and healthy. Do you have any simple ideas for me to either make it more like one of the bonsai trees, or should I just let it grow into a tree?
Well, I would let it kind of grow on its own, but maybe do a little bit of pruning as it grows. So it has maybe the arching type or that distinctive shape to it. It has it by itself. It does it kind of naturally. And you might do a little bit of pruning to assist it, but it shouldn't require a great deal of pruning.
All right. And this is from Sarah in Cedar Rapids. We have an early apple tree that is 30 plus years old. In 2008, it was pushed over by straight line winds. We were able to prune it back and prop it up, but it continued to grow at an angle. It has successfully produced since then. This year, we had a bumper crop of apples, and the weight of the crop split the trunk. This was a month ago. The leaves are still green. Is there any way to save the tree, or should we cut it down?
I would remove it after the harvest season this year, right, because it split. There's just really, I don't think, a good way to save it. So I would get through the harvest season and then maybe remove it this winter.
All right. Next, Gerald is on the line in Harpers Ferry. Hi, Gerald.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I've got an English walnut tree. It's about 9 years old. It's never done anything. What can I do? Anything?
You have just one English walnut?
No, I have two, actually.
Okay. Well, maybe they're just not mature enough yet at this point. They have to grow and mature before they are capable of producing fruit. I would typically expect fruit within maybe 10 years.
Probably early then.
So I would give the trees a few more years to produce some fruit. What size are they at this point?
Well, the one is about 10 feet high. The other one, the deer almost killed it last year, rubbing their antlers on it. It's kind of bushy now.
Okay. So maybe a few more years before they bear fruit. 10 foot is not very big. So hopefully when they get to be 15, 20 feet, they start to bear fruit.
Okay. Hopefully I'll live that long.
All right. Well, hang in there, Gerald. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Next up, Holly's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. I have about a dozen tomato plants, and I'd say about four or five of them are wilting. And no brown, just kind of wilting. And I had put compost in the soil earlier this year at the start of the season. I feed them with a specific tomato food about every week to 10 days. But on about a third of the plants, the fruit is not growing to a mature size. But although it is getting ripe, but the plants themselves are kind of wilting on those where the fruit is not maturing or getting a proper size. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, they may have a vascular wilt, either verticillium wilt or fusarium wilt. They are vascular wilts. They enter the plant through the root system. And basically what they end up doing is they interrupt the flow of water from the roots to the foliage, and so the plant begins to wilt. And it becomes progressively worse, and oftentimes the plants eventually die. There's really no way to prevent that. Most of your hybrids that you buy are wilt-resistant, but they're not immune. They can still get it. The heirloom varieties tend to be very susceptible to it. Just rotate next year. Plant them in a different location.
All right, and here you can give me a one-word answer for this, hopefully, for Craig in Forest City. He has an apple tree started from seed. Should he cover it during the winter?
No.
All right. Richard Duran, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. Aaron Stile, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Aaron Stile is manager of public programs at Ryman Gardens in Ames. And remember, you can see pictures of the trial gardens at Ryman Gardens on our website later today. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Sean McLean. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.